بسم الله والحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. As usual, I'm going to give it about 30 seconds, maybe a minute. I'll wait until everybody gets in so that people don't miss the beginning, because the beginning is still quite important. There's actually quite a bit to go through with regards to the nature of autism. So today we're going to be discussing the topic of autism. If anybody has any issues with camera quality or the microphone quality, please let me know. And so today we're going to be discussing autism. What is it, and how should we perceive it? The biggest problem that I find when it comes to autism, when it comes with most parents that I come across, and I've spent about 8 years, 8 or 9 years, meeting with families and discussing with people and studying it from all angles. And what I found is that the majority of parents don't understand how to look at it. So they don't see it very positively. They see it as a disease or as a disability. And even though there's an aspect of it that's a disability. And so a lot of parents, they become a little bit confused with how to perceive it. I'll give you just a quick example. I was flying back from Turkey. And on the way back, there was a lady, I was flying, I think, to Turkey back from UAE. I can't remember. But there was a lady on the airplane, and her son had symptoms of autism, I could tell. And this is one thing I'll talk about, which is that after all these years of study, I can usually now tell when a person has autism relatively quickly. And I'll explain. I'll go into more detail. So this lady was on the flight, and her son was on his phone. And both my wife and I, who were on the car, saw the boy, and we realized that he had autism. And so afterwards, we spoke to the lady, and she was very upset and very frustrated with him. And we said, like, we love the fact that your son was so calm during the flight and so on. And she was like, no, he drives me crazy. And she was really, really frustrated and flustered. And the thing is, I wanted to have more time to explain to her what her son's going through, the fact that he looked really bright. So you can tell a lot of children that have autism, you can tell just by looking at them. You see there's a sharpness, there's an intelligence about them. They're very smart, and you can see that quality in them. And so we didn't get a chance to explain much. My wife ended up getting her phone number, but we weren't able to contact her. But anyways, just the point is that most parents, the problem with them is they're distraught. They're upset. What am I going to do with my child? I just saw a video of a lady. Honestly, I understand what she's going through, and everyone has to go through what they have to go through. But for me, I don't really like the fact that a lot of parents are just so, they treat it like it's such a horrible thing. And they don't realize that the day that I realized that my son Muhammad had autism was a very happy day for me. Of course, it was a shock. I didn't really expect it to happen. But when I looked at his reality, I realized that it's not just a blessing as in it's a blessing as in it's a test, or it's a blessing as in we're happy with whatever we have. No, it's a blessing as in autism is known as what's called the disease of genius. So some people might argue this is not the case, but in my opinion, I believe that all autistic children that actually have autism, and not some other ailment that's considered, it's misunderstood as autism, all have the potential for being extremely talented, if not genius, in a particular field. And I believe that this is by design from Allah Azza wa Jal, and I'll go into more detail about that. Now, before I go into any more detail, I'm going to just start by explaining the basics of what autism is for everyone to understand. First of all, what is autism? There's a lot of ways of defining autism. There's lots of ways for people to say that it's a lack of social capability. These are all the symptoms. Autism actually is a nervous disorder. It's a disorder with the nervous system. And you can call it, I don't even like the word disorder, but the nervous system functions differently than most people. Due to the nerves being either extra sensitive or malfunctioning or functioning in a different way, it causes the autistic person to, or if you want to call it autism. And I think that maybe in time people will start redefining using a different term rather than autism, but we'll see. But the point is that it's a disorder or a different way of how the nervous system functions within that individual. And what this causes is for the senses to be kind of turned up. So hearing, they'll hear, their hearing is extra sensitive, their touch is extra sensitive, their taste is extra sensitive, their sense of smell is extra sensitive, and their seeing is extra sensitive. Sometimes all of them are extra sensitive, and sometimes senses are more. Sometimes they're turned up so high, that the senses are turned up so high that the child will end up Becoming overwhelmed. It starts to almost become like feedback. It's like having really, really loud noise going on. So that's why you'll find some autistic children with very, very high sensitivity to touch. They'll only wear certain clothes. Very high sensitivity to taste, and also touch will affect the textures that they're willing to eat. So if their sense of touch is very, very strong, then even their tongue can't have certain textures in their mouth. There's another thing related to that, which is that the way that the mind visualizes certain things, the visualization is so powerful in the mind of an autistic child in some cases, that when they eat something like rice, they imagine worms or maggots. So that's why a lot of times they'll throw up and so on. So you have to be careful of what it is that what they associate as a mental image. But again, these are all details that we'll go through. So the sense of smell, so you'll put a child in a car, for example, and the child will start panicking and freaking out. Sometimes it's because the car does not smell good. And the smell for us is okay, but for autistic children, it's way too strong or something that really bothers them. And the same thing for the sense of taste. There's only certain foods that they're willing to eat and so on and so forth. So the senses are much stronger, but not only that, sometimes they will sense certain things like frequencies or light waves that most people don't sense. So there are cases where some autistic children will be able to hear certain sounds. Now I'm not going to jump too quickly into it. I believe that, and so just to be clear, there's about five or six major sections for this topic that are to be discussed. One of the things that I want to discuss is that autism is genetic. And so going back to myself, so when I look at myself when I was a teenager, I have a lot of symptoms of autism. So I guess high-functioning autism. My daughter has symptoms of high-functioning autism. And as I said, my son he's a 3 out of 4 in severity. So he has severe autism. And I look back at my family and I find that there's lots of people in my family that have lots of symptoms of relatively severe autism. And so for me, for example, and a lot of people have this as well, I can hear capacitors in printers, or in electronics, and other people. So when I walk past the computer in the house, my wife, of course, laughs, because I'll right away tell her, unplug the printer, before I even see the printer. And she says, I can't hear anything at all, and no one else in the house can hear it. But for me, it's very noticeable, scratching, hissing sound that just fills my hearing. And so everybody has, so sometimes the person who's what they say is on the spectrum of autism, they can hear certain things that other people can't. And that's why a lot of times a child is having an attack, like they're having a meltdown, and so they're banging their head and they're plugging their ears and they're screaming or something. It's because they're sensing something possibly that you aren't sensing. They're smelling a smell that you're not smelling. There's something is a little too bright, something is a little too loud, and so on and so forth. So you have to understand that it has to do with this. So if you are on the spectrum, or if somebody you know or your own child is on the spectrum, you have to understand what the child is going through. It's all about the five senses. They're turned up very, very high. They're very, very sensitive. And a lot of times they sense, they'll detect something that's going on that you're actually not even sensing. So that's the very first thing that I wanted to go through, which is to understand that it's a nervous system issue, as the senses are really, really fine-tuned and really high, turned really high up. The second thing that I want to discuss is the differentiation between physical ailments and the mental state of an autistic person. I think this is one of the most important things that right now research is going through, and I'm writing a book on this, and I'm one of the major areas of the project that I'm working on is to identify two things. There's two major things that I hope that'll get researched and clarified better. One is the fact that the physical ailments that's associated with autism, they vary. So you'll find one child has an issue, another child doesn't. One child has real bad muscle issues, another one has none of this. He seems perfectly normal, but he's just not communicative. So there's lots and lots of things that are variable between autistic children, but the mental state is common to all of them. The severity of social, of the ability to socialize, whether it's communication or self-awareness and so on, that goes up and down, but it's there, so it's consistent. But when it comes to whether it's gastrointestinal problems or allergies or all these sorts of things, these things vary between child and child. Some of them don't have it and some of them do. So Mohammed, for example, has allergies. He's allergic to a lot of things, but he doesn't have gastrointestinal problems. He doesn't have muscle issues. He's actually very, very coordinated. He's as coordinated to the point where it's weird. He'll climb up onto something where he just has a tiny little ledge, and he's trying to grab something, and he's like on one leg, and he's very, very balanced, and he's very coordinated. He could jump from certain things to another. So he has that. So he has certain things that he can't do and certain things that he can. So the physical ailments, because of the nervous system being so turned up, that maybe the body responds during the growth in the womb or after it's born. Allahu a'lam what all the different possibilities are. But it seems that the physical ailments are sometimes, obviously caused by the nervous system being the way it is, but it doesn't necessarily mean that is autism. Autism isn't the physical ailments. Autism is the mental state. And I really think that's kind of how it needs to be defined. We need to look at our children and look at the autistic people around us. We need to just focus on their mental state. Now, the physical ailments, those are the things that we should be focusing on trying to cure or trying to minimize the damage or minimize the effect of. So gastrointestinal problems, again, such as myself, I've always had gastrointestinal problems. And there's lots of things that essentially throughout the years that have been issues. Lots of, again, with Mohammed, his allergies, with other children, like the head of the autism research department at the university here in NY City. His daughter has some major physical issues, like muscle issues, and she was just in intensive care. May Allah cure her soon. And so these types of issues, they're all variable depending on different circumstances, essentially, because the body's so sensitive, it kind of goes in a different direction in terms of its damage. And so you get medical attention for that, and you can take all sorts of whether you want to go with herbal medication or whether you want to go with the heavy metals thing that people were talking about. I haven't researched a lot of this stuff. And because I told myself I was going to stay away from these things until Mohammed was around 10 years old, between 8 and 10, because that's usually when a child comes out of the non-communicative period and starts to communicate. So essentially, we need to separate between the mental state and the physical ailments. Now, these are all symptoms. So the symptoms of the mental state primarily is what I like to call hyper-rationality. So when a person grows up and they go through their, essentially the body grows and a lot of the problems get fixed usually later on in life. A person's ailments when they're a child or when they're in their teens usually goes away when they go and hit their 20s and 30s. Not all go away, but they really get minimized and the body starts to deal with it. And it starts to become more difficult to tell that a person has autism. But what you'll find is there are certain symptoms, such as being monotone in their voice, such as being really awkward, very, very awkward in their social interactions. You'll find that they lack self-awareness. That's a major area of study, which is recognizing that early children in their early years that have autism, they don't really realize, they don't have self-awareness. They're not really aware that they exist. That's why when somebody talks to them, a lot of times they just repeat what they hear. They don't realize that they're being spoken to. So that's another area of research, and so on and so forth. So the mental state, the biggest symptom of the mental state is the awkwardness and the lack of self-awareness and the lack of ability to socialize properly. The physical, as I said, if you find gastrointestinal problems and allergies and other handicaps, you can find them, and once you put them all together, you can begin to get an idea that a person, that a child has autism. Now, the final thing that I wanted to mention with regard just to the introduction of what autism is recognizing that autistic children and adults have one really big issue that affects everything that they do, which is that a lot of things that are considered background noise or things that your brain just essentially doesn't even process. It happens subconsciously, but generally it all becomes background sounds and background lights and background smells and so on become foreground. So what happens is that an autistic person will react much more to there's certain things that you're not even hearing. Like right now, there's a clock ticking to the over here. Now, most of us will just ignore the clock. Same thing if a car drives by behind us. Most of us won't even notice that there's cars driving by outside. There's lots of things. For example, if there might be like a tiny little flashing light on a small device in the corner little things like this that most of us will just kind of tune out. The autistic mind puts it at the foreground. Not everything, but it's just the mind decides for itself. It's a really strange thing. Again, it's not very well understood, but the mind will put it at the foreground. And so, again, I'm going to be using myself as a lot of examples, and a lot of people will not fully, not people, a lot of people won't really believe that I'm on the spectrum, I'll explain it later on as to why, the why I know, essentially, when I look at my teenage years and a lot of things that are going on right now, how I've been able to mitigate all the problems, or not all, but a lot of the problems so that a person can behave normally. And that's one of the reasons why I want to go into this research, is because I want people to understand that the mind can be rewired to an extent. Temple Grandin talks about this. If you go and watch her video where she's addressing Google, she gives a talk to Google. You can look it up if you Google it, Temple Grandin speech Google. You'll listen to this whole talk. You'll really get a better understanding. She did a lot of brain scans of herself and other people and so on, and she did a lot of research, and she found that it's essentially the way that the brain is literally wired. I forget what she calls them, cables. I forget exactly what the technical term is for it. And so she talks about that these cables, a lot of them can be rewired. A lot of them can't. They're just set, and then some of them can be moved, depending on how you train yourself. That's why it's so important not to allow autistic children to become isolated. They have to be constantly in a situation where they're forced to socialize and so on, because you want to rewire some of those cables so that the child starts to become more communicative and normal. But most importantly, what happens is that a lot of the background sounds that most people just kind of put in the background become foreground sounds. So for me, a lot of times that if there's a small piece of fluff floating in the air, my body will react like it's like a baseball coming at me, basically. So a lot of times there's certain things, and that works both in favor of the autistic mind and against the autistic mind. It works in favor because it makes you often sharper. It allows you to notice things a lot more. It allows you to analyze reality a lot better. People become much better in terms of physics and math because it's all about sensory perception. But the most important thing is just to understand that a lot of times your child, if they're getting annoyed about a sound, as an example, when I'm sitting with Muhammad and I'm sitting with my son Omar, and Omar plays a game, and even if there's a little bit of sound, but the sound comes up, right away Muhammad plugs his ears and he can't handle, because A, his hearing is extra sensitive, and B, because the sound is you can't just tune it out. It just becomes the foreground for you, and so you can't just do something while there's this loud noise going on. And again, it's a bit of a running joke in my family that whenever I'm, and for me, that my hearing sensitivity and the inability to put things in the background ironically happens the more I am focused on typing a complex post or complex response or writing a book or something like this. When I'm focused on a really complicated idea that I'm trying to put together in my head, suddenly small things like people like making a small clicking sound with their mouth, scratching their face, moving something becomes really, really loud and obnoxious in my ear. And it's very hard to tune it out. It's almost like somebody has if somebody takes a, just crumples a small piece of paper on the other side of the room, it's like they're crumpling it right next to my ear. And so essentially this is what it kind of revolves around, that there's these primary details. The fact that it's it's the nervous system that is tuned differently. It's tuned very kind of like, you know, you're turning the volume way, way up. Sometimes that can cause feedback. And the second thing is the fact that, so the senses end up becoming much stronger. So when we talk about the nervous system, we're talking about the five senses. So you can see, your hearing, your taste, your smell, your touch, and your sight, your smell, your touch, your hearing, and your taste. And so these are all turned up very high. And so in some cases, the autistic mind can detect certain things like wavelengths of sound or light that an average person just simply will either tune out or won't notice. And the whole thing about background versus foreground. So things that most people have as background noise will become foreground. And sometimes there's the point where it's obnoxious and unbearable, and it's just completely takes over. That's one of the reasons why autistic people or people who are on the autistic end of the spectrum, they tend to want to be isolated. You want to be alone because even actually in Arabic, by the way, autism in Arabic is called marad al-tawahud, which is such an interesting thing. It's called the illness of wanting to be alone, right? Or being, tawahud means kind of like isolation, right? It's the illness of isolation, because they notice that autistic children want to be alone. They play alone for very long periods of time. They study alone for very long periods of time. They're very focused because they're inside. They're processing. They're always working things throughout. And that's the next point that I want to get into, which is autistic mind in terms of talent. So that's the reason why they want to get away, because they want to reduce all these sounds and all this. That's why they don't like small talk. They don't like adults who are on the spectrum or on the autistic end of the spectrum. They don't like small talk. They don't want to sit there and all these noises and people laughing. And I mean, it's a lot. Don't get me wrong. They're just like normal people. Obviously, they love to socialize. Even the ones who are very, very severe to the point of non-communication. When they write their books, I mean, a lot of them, they're not communicating, but they're writing fantastic books. Like that book, there's a great book that people should read. It's called The Reason Why I Jump. The boy explains, essentially, he's non-functional, his body doesn't even work, but he's able to type, and he types very eloquently. And he explains that, essentially, I love to socialize and be with people just as much as everyone else, but I feel as if I'm bothering everybody. And there's other things too. And also it's the sounds and a lot of things that are distracting and very difficult to navigate. So this is the gist of the nature of autism, of what we know. Now, there's one thing I want to explain, and this is going to be essentially the primary work of this foundation that I want to establish. And I've been working on this for a long time, and I'm very confident of the core details of it. It's still a work in progress, meaning that every few weeks and every couple of months, there's a new. I'm just the details get pushed a little further, and I understand a little more, and I add a lot more to the concept of it. But I'm beginning to realize that I think that this is actually very, very accurate, and I wouldn't explain it here unless that's the reason why I'm actually explaining, is because I believe that it's actually very accurate, and I want to explain it. I want people to understand it. So as I said, I've been studying autism for about 8 or 9 years. I started studying it about a year before Muhammad was born. Primarily because I opened up an abattoir, and I wanted to understand animal psychology so that we didn't have to electrocute animals or put them in any sort of uncomfortable position. So I began studying Temple Grandin's work, and that led me to autism. And then when Muhammad was born, I had already had about 2 years, a year and a half or so of research into autism. And I've read lots and lots of books and watched countless videos and articles, and I'm writing two books now. Though it's going a little slow, but I'm writing books now on autism as well. I spoke to lots and lots of people, obviously countless people, about autism, and I've dealt with children and families and so on and so forth. And it has to do, obviously, with what's monitoring human behavior. There's no, at this point in time, there's no way of taking a blood sample, saying, well, you have autism. Rather, it's looking at human behavior and watching patterns. And alhamdulillah, shukr, due to the da'wah and spending literally, obviously, 20 years discussing with tens of thousands of people, I've come to notice people's behavior patterns. And I began noticing that there's a certain number of people that behave in a certain particular way. And so I began to realize that these people who would behave this way, I could never really categorize why they behave that way all these years. And now that I've studied this, now I realize they're all on the autistic end of the spectrum. And so the bottom line about this is that I believe that there's not a spectrum that you're on. So it's not like you have a cerebral palsy and how severe is it, or you have cancer and where is it, and so you have autism and so you're on a spectrum of autism and where are you on the spectrum. I think that this is actually inaccurate. I really firmly believe that everybody is on a spectrum, and autism is one end of it. The reason why I believe this is because I noticed that some people, that everybody sort of had some of the symptoms of autism. The more severe, the more of the symptoms you have, the more suddenly you're more and more autistic. But everybody has some of the qualities of the autistic mind. And I couldn't really figure out, well, how does this work? And as I kind of mulled it over and I listened to all these talks and people kind of commenting on it, it kind of began to crystallize that all human beings are on a spectrum. One end of the spectrum is autism, and the other end of the spectrum is most likely bipolar. And the reason why these two are at the end is because if you're in the middle and you start having more and more the mental qualities, your brain is wired in a particular way where all the cables, we'll call them cables, are wired to one particular side, we'll call it a side, you become more and more similar. You look more and more like you're autistic. You become more monotone. You become more hyper-rational. Everything is about facts and figures. Everything is black and white. Even though you might be emotional, but you don't judge things emotionally. You judge things rationally. Emotional rhetoric is very frustrating for the autistic mind. It's all about math and facts and figures and black and white. And so that's as you go further and further on towards the autistic end of the spectrum. And then when you go more and more towards the bipolar end, and so, by the way, once you get closer and closer to the edge of the autism spectrum, you become sort of your social, because that's the other side, your social and emotional, it starts to sort of not behave properly. So you become so rational and so bent on the maths and the sciences and the facts that suddenly you're no longer you're less inclined to judge things or even look at emotions, and you just become socially malfunction, because this end of the spectrum is about rationality, and this end of the spectrum is about emotion and abstract. So this is the objective side, and this is the abstract side. So as you move more and more towards the bipolar end of things, you become more and more emotional. You begin judging things emotionally. Everything is kind of in the grays and the feelings and the general meanings and reading between the lines and so on and so forth. So a human being essentially will begin to judge things based on how they feel. And the more severe it becomes, the more manic the emotions become, and the whole bipolar thing starts to kick in, because the emotions are so strong and everything is so much about how you feel and so on, that it suddenly becomes erratic and it starts to kind of spiral out of control. The same as the more rational you become, to the point where you suddenly become really kind of cold and mean, actually. A lot of times autistic people, if you look at Steve Jobs, if you look at Nikola Tesla, they become very cold and dismissive. Actually, a lot of the classical scholars you find, and this is what I'm saying, is that this is the spectrum that has always existed for mankind. So this is not a new problem. This is something that has always existed, because if you look at, again, Nikola Tesla, Einstein, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, all these people are on the autistic end of the spectrum, and their severity varies depending, but you find that they become colder and colder, more awkward, because they're either really nice and friendly, and that makes them very, very awkward, or they just decide to hell with it. I don't even care about human beings. I don't care about human interaction. All I care about is getting things done. So they become really cold, and that's why you find autistic children, they don't really want to get hugged, they don't really care about affection, they don't even want to make eye contact. Now, that's two things. This one is the kind of not really caring much about this sort of thing. And the second thing is because of the nervous system. So because the nerves, sometimes they're just too much. They cause too much feeling, and that causes the muscles to kind of overload. And I'll get to that a little bit later. But the core point is that everybody's on the spectrum, and most people are somewhere in the middle. Most people are a bit of a balance of the emotional and the rational, a little more of the kind of adventure and reading between the lines and between the kind of black and white and judging everything. And so you'll find most people are somewhere in between there. And by the way, off topic from the topic of autism and into the topic of dawah for dawah carriers who are watching this, it's very important to understand the spectrum. And as I said, because of all these years of carrying dawah and discussing with people, and obviously looking at Islam and how it applies on the world, you begin to it's become clear that everybody is this dichotomy. It's very important to understand this, because when you're discussing with somebody and this person is a hyper-rational person, he just wants to hear evidences. He just wants to hear, what does the Quran say? What does the Sunnah say? Prove to me that this says X and Y. But you have other people. And so a lot of Shabab who are, a lot of Muslims or who are dawah carriers who are more on the autistic end, who are more black and white, everything's facts and figures, they don't know how to deal with these Muslims who are, everything is the grays and everything is open to interpretation and everything is about love and everything is about experience and enjoying the experience and so on. And so the autistic mind finds that really annoying. And we'll call it the bipolar mind, although they're not bipolar, I'm saying the autistic end and the bipolar end. But the more emotional mind will look at all these rational, you know, hyper-rational, hyper-facts, black and white kind of people as being dismissive, and you people are too rigid, and everything has to be a certain. So you see, that's the problem, is that these people have trouble communicating with each other. And if they understand how each other's minds work, they'll understand how to get through to each other. So again, I'm going off topic, but just a quick point here is that the people who are on the more emotional end of things, so the more on the bipolar end of things, if they were to address people who are more black and white, recognizing that this person just needs facts and figures. So you got to prove it. And if you don't prove it, you're just not going to get through. Then you can go towards the emotional about, you know, love and all this kind of stuff. But you start with facts and figures, and then you build on the emotions, because the autistic end still want emotions, but it has to be founded on facts. Once you found it on fact, then you can build all the rest of the emotions and the motivation and the excitement and so on. But you don't start with emotions and excitement, because that if the mind has if the autistic mind isn't convinced, if it doesn't see that, okay, this is kind of at least close to black and white, it's just going to get very annoyed with it and frustrated, and sometimes it'll just obviously be very dismissive. On the autistic end, you have to understand, if you find yourself everything's black and white and facts and figures, you have to understand that the people on the bipolar end, you got to start with love and feelings, and you gotta start with kind of winning them and motivating them and talking about Jannah and talking about the implications. If you do this, then this will happen and this will be good or whatever. And then you say, Allah said and the Messenger said. You'll find actually a lot of Sahaba actually did this. When they were dealing with certain people who are more emotional, they wouldn't actually say, Allah said and the Messenger said. They would actually start by saying, the Arabs would never accept this. The implications would be this. The consequences would be that. So that's the thing, is that depends on the person who you're speaking to, you would use different approaches depending on the type of mind that you're addressing. So that's an important thing to understand. So the point is that every human being is on a spectrum, and it's just about finding where you are and the severity. So, you know, I'm still working on essentially, I guess, a questionnaire, a way of testing a person to kind of find where they are. And I'll give you a bit of an idea of how far I've come, alhamdulillah, with this theory. There was a brother locally, a few years back, it just clicked. I realized he's on the spectrum. He's on the autism. He's severe. Like he's what you would call today high functioning autism. And so I went out with a brother, and we went out for a tea. And I'm not sure if he's watching right now, actually, but so we sat down. And I told him, I believe you have autism. I think you're on the autistic spectrum. And they said, well, why would you think that? And I know some people are going to say, well, that's reckless. You shouldn't be throwing these words around. It's reckless if you're not really sure of what you've concluded. But if you are as sure as I am now of what I've concluded, it's not reckless. So, because I was sure. I was 100% sure he had autism. There's no doubt in my mind. But he was a regular brother. He was very academic. He's very, very well studied. But again, monotone, he's got, there's, you know, some issues in self-awareness, all these sorts of things, the same symptoms of these sorts of things. And so I sat down with a brother and I told him that I believe that you have autism. And so he said, well, why would you say that? And so I explained to him what I believe autism is and so on and so forth and the way that the mind works. And so forget about, and like, aside from the physical ailments, because he doesn't have them, but the mental state. So then as I'm explaining it, he suddenly has a smile on his face and he's kind of like grinning at me. And so I tell him, so I'm finishing my explanation. And then I look at him and I say, well, you know, what's up with the smile? He tells me, when I was about 3 years old, or sorry, about 4 or 5 years old, I think actually maybe a little older, sorry, I can't remember the exact ages that he told me. But he said at around 3 years old, he stopped talking. He just remembers consciously choosing, I don't want to talk anymore. So he stopped talking for a while, I don't know, a year or two or three. And then so his mother took him in for an assessment, and he was diagnosed with autism. And they were so irritated with the diagnosis, they just threw it out and said, to hell with this. You know, there's no way that I have autism. This is dumb. All I did was just play with some toys. I have autism now? So they just rejected the whole thing. And up until that day, essentially, as far as I know, it was never really brought up. So when I told him, I believe that you're on the autistic spectrum, he found it kind of, obviously, interesting that I could see it in him. And so I explained to him why there's certain things and certain symptoms. And so it's just to understand that everybody is on the spectrum. So I won't go into too much detail. Now, over time, I'm going to be making more and more videos, elaborating more and more on this spectrum, this actual, like, so today, if you were to think about it, of the spectrum that I'm talking about, the autistic spectrum is one end. So it's 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's the spectrum. One is called high functioning. It used to be called Asperger's. Now it's called high functioning autism. And then two is a severity where there's indications of lack of communication, but there's still some communication and the child's a little bit normal. But there's some, again, I'd have to look up the exact definition. The third is when there's more, obviously is more severe. There's no response to calling their name and so on and so forth. And then the four out of the four in severity is obviously there's physical ailments and so on and so forth. And so these four are just one end. And as you get towards the high functioning autism, then suddenly you go towards you have normal people, what they call normal people, the average person, or they call them neurotypical. But the point is that it's wrong to call people neurotypical because that's ignoring the far end of the other spectrum, which is the really, really emotional people. And I don't see I'm not saying emotional as in they're always an emotional mess. I'm talking about how they perceive things, because autistic people can be emotional, but they don't judge things emotionally. They don't look at things about how do I feel about this, and I'm going to judge based on how I feel. Autism judges based on what the person senses with their five senses, what their mind can detect. And so it's very much, because again, the senses are turned up. So it's all about what the senses are giving. It's possible that the people on the bipolar end, their senses are turned down. They don't sense as much. And so what happens is that they essentially judge more with their emotions on how they feel. It's kind of like, think about it this way. Imagine if a person has night vision, really extremely powerful vision. His eyesight is incredible and he has night vision and you're in a dark room. How are you going to navigate? You're going to navigate by looking around and you're going to say, well, don't go here. And why are you going there? You're going to be very, very rational about what you're doing in this room. But if a person's eyesight is really bad, they don't have night vision, they're in the dark and they can barely see anything at all. And their sight's already bad. They don't have their glasses with them or something. How are they going to judge? They're going to feel their way around. Now, again, we're talking senses, but you can get the sense, you can get the basic gist of it. When your senses aren't really, really very turned up and you can't really, like, you're not being bombarded with huge amounts of information that your brain just almost can't deal with, you kind of have to navigate life differently. So you go by how you feel about things and so on. And this can be very, very powerful. These people are usually exceptionally good in social situations. They're very good at navigating a crowd, and when they're sitting with a group of people, they can get a feel for the tone and how to talk to a person. They're usually quite patient. The autistic end is usually quite impatient. The bipolar, they're usually more impatient, and they kind of look at things by how they feel. So don't get me wrong. Let's not say that the bipolar end are people who are just crazy emotional. No, only the very extreme end are bipolar, and they're very, very they're malfunctioning emotionally. But when you're kind of in the high functioning autism, the high functioning bipolar, I guess you want to call it, these people are they navigate things by sensing, by feeling, by, I'm talking sensing the feelings and the environment, and they kind of go by more general things, and they're usually more about caring about others and so on and so forth. So this is more the nurses and so on. You'll find the vast majority of people who are on the autistic end are male, and the vast majority of people who are on the bipolar end are female. So women are usually a little more emotional in terms of their judgment. They'll judge things based on how they feel. They'll look at, rather than literally, so autistic end is more literal. It's about literally what is said. It's about literally what has happened. Whereas the bipolar end is more about figurative and meaning and reading between the lines and so on and so forth. So these are the thing about, this is generally the spectrum of humanity. The reason why this is so important, so there's so many reasons why this is so important to understand, but one of the things that's, in my opinion, the most important thing for a parent to understand is that, going back only to talk about the autism end of things, your role is to figure out what your autistic child is good at. Because the further you go towards the rational end of things, and the literal end of things, and the math and scientific end of things, the better the human being will be at something world-related. Now, of course, everybody has talent all across the board, but the further you go out towards extremities, the stronger that talent is going to be. So suddenly people become geniuses, savants, and so on. So Muhammad, he's way off on he's a 3 out of 4, so he's just one step away from the outer edge of the whole spectrum. He knows as I mentioned this to many people before, and even in the post, but for those who didn't read through it or who haven't heard this before, Muhammad knows over 15 languages now. So he's non-communicative, which is ironic, which is we're just waiting for him to start talking, essentially. I mean, we put our trust on Allah Azza wa Jalla, we're waiting for Allah Azza wa Jalla to give him back, to give him his ability to speak. But he knows words, and lots of words, from over 15 languages. I counted 10, then I started counting up towards 15, and I realized I just lost count. Sometimes he's talking and he's just saying words, and I have no idea what language he's speaking. He knows how to, for example, he installed Ukrainian on the computer, so he knows how to type on the computer. I have videos of this, by the way, so in time I'll start uploading the videos of what he's doing. Yuta, I think there was a word called Yuta, which is, I think, car, and he wrote the word beetle in Ukrainian. So he knows how to type words in Ukrainian. I don't know where he learned this from. He just taught himself how to type in Ukrainian. And he knows Russian, obviously. He knows Arabic, French, English, Spanish, and so on. So he's got, obviously, a large number of languages and variations of certain Latin languages and so on. So the way that we noticed this early on in Muhammad's life is because I had studied autism to the point where I realized that autism is what's called the disease of genius. So for me, when I looked at Muhammad, I was just trying to figure out, well, what is his talent? What did Allah Azza wa Jalla make him to do? So the what's really important to understand is that this the autism can be looked at one of two ways. The vast majority of people who are studying and researching autism are studying it from the perspective of evolution. So they're looking at it as just something that recently happened. So, you know, mankind's evolved and it's just now this is showing. And how do we understand this from the randomness of the mutations of human genetics? And it's fine to kind of, it's, I guess to a large extent, it's okay to research it this way because there's still a lot of good to be found in this in looking at it this way. But the thing is that it must be also looked at, and it primarily must be looked at as by design. Allah Azza wa Jalla has designed mankind to run this planet. So you'll find that if everybody was an engineer, well, there wouldn't be anybody to clean up. If everybody was loved to clean or become a doctor or a nurse or a caretaker or a midwife or something like this, well, nobody would build any buildings. So Allah Azza wa Jalla assigns capabilities to different people and talents. And I'm noticing this in my own children. So I have 7 children, alhamdulillah. And so I've noticed now all of my children, when they're born, I'm telling you, within just the first month or two of them being born, you can tell who they are. So at first, I couldn't figure it out, obviously. But as I started having 4, 5, 6, I began to notice, hold on a second. The children are, when they're born, whatever they their personality was like, so they're really, really talkative, or they really love certain hands-on things, or that's their personality. So it's intrinsically chosen for them, what their general realm of responsibilities in this world are. They're inclined towards wanting to be in, whether it's physical things, like some people love physical activities, or certain people love discussions, or certain people love management, or certain people love business. So people are the whole, Allah Azza wa Jalla has chosen for everybody their roles, not specifically what exactly they're going to do necessarily, but their general realm of interest. And he puts them all across the planet and for us to take care of the world and manage a part of society and so that we create a balance. And that's what Allah has done this. And so therefore, I believe that people on the autistic end are our scientists and mathematicians and people who will bring progress in these fields. And so they're able to do things. It's not that they have extra tools. It's not like, because whenever we talk about genius, we think, wow, it must be some like extra, like it's not some extra brain piece or some magical capability. It's nothing like that. It's just the brain is sensing more and processing more, or sometimes sensing a little bit of an extra reality that the other people aren't noticing or whatever else it might be. And so therefore the autistic mind, it's by design from Allah Azza wa Jal, the dedication of the mind to certain tasks such as maths and sciences and things that are obviously more in terms of progress in science and technology and so on. And that's why when a lot of us look at microchips and really advanced technology, we just, how on earth? But when you think about the autistic mind and all these autistic geniuses, yeah, it becomes, you know, the calculation capability that they have in their head is given to them by Allah Azza wa Jal to achieve a certain task. And what's interesting is that certain task, that certain mind type, has the social aspect removed from it. So you think about the wisdom behind this, which is such an interesting thing. You find that you have people who are on the autistic end of the spectrum are hyper-rational, hyper-math and science and so on, but then the social thing doesn't work. But I always thought to myself, why? Why did Allah remove this from them? Because if you look at it in terms of just random evolution, you're not going to ask that question. You're going to say, well, it's just a malfunction for some reason. But if you look at it by design, then you'll say, well, why did Allah remove this social thing? And you realize, and I realized, so and obviously because I don't like, as some of you might notice, you may or may not, I don't really like socializing too much. I find small talk really irritating and so on. And so, because for me, I'm a 1 out of 4 on the autistic end. So I'm what you would call high functioning autism. And again, I'll tell you in a few minutes why I'm there. And so why is the social end taken away? And I realized because socializing is such a massive waste of time when it comes to science and technology and research. So if you're researching things and you're just only interested in researching things, and you're interested in understanding things better and furthering some scientific research or math project, socializing is such a massive waste of time. Lots of times, for example, like when I want to go and have a discussion, let's say I go to a gathering of brothers and I want to discuss something related to the da'wah, whether it's the fard of the khilaf, or whether it's an aspect of fiqh and sharia, whether it's the person's misunderstanding of how ahadith, ahad, and so on so forth work, or whether it's a tafsir al-Qur'an and the qira'at, whatever else it might be. And so I go to a gathering, and in my mind, there's an objective. I'm there to achieve an objective, which is to discuss this, to clarify this. That's why I'm there. And then these brothers are just chit-chatting and small talking and whatever. It's just a waste of time. We're not achieving anything. Now, on the bipolar end, the person will see that this is achieving things. You're enjoying, you're creating, you're building relations, you're building bonds and networks. So the people on this end are great at networking and creating connections and so on. But people on this, I'm just going to quickly read this in the comment, a person said. Yeah, so I'll come back to some of these comments. So the people on the bipolar end, the socializing and so on is very useful, but for things that they want to achieve, which is networking and building connections and links and people who owe you favors and you can get things done and whatever else it might be. People on the autistic end, it's just about rational things. I want to fix this. I want to clarify this. I want to understand this. I want to work out this calculation and so on. And therefore, by removing the socializing aspect from a scientist or a mathematician or something like this, you basically allow the mind to dedicate all of its time to only wanting to do these things, and it just has no interest in wasting its time and just socializing and chit-chatting and doing all these sorts of things. And so keep in mind the bipolar end, look at this type of mentality as being, you're boring and you're antisocial, and the answer is no. All human beings have these qualities that create the spectrum of humanity. And these things are important. They're so important because the autistic end are our geniuses. There are scientists and mathematicians. They're the reason why we have rockets that can go to the moon and essentially slingshot itself around whether it's the moon or the earth or whatever other bodies or planets that exist out in space. They can do the calculations for these things. Again, the reason why we have computers and cameras and so on is obviously because of the autistic mind, people who are on this end of the spectrum. And of course, the bipolar end has its own place and extreme importance in every aspect of society. And we have to appreciate all areas and all aspects of these things. So autism isn't new. It's not something where suddenly, oh, it's a big epidemic. Maybe the ailments that related to autism are becoming a little more noticeable or a little more severe, maybe due to the diets, maybe due to the air, maybe due to a lot of things that we're doing. Things are becoming a little more noticeable in that regard. But the autistic mind has always existed. And it's by design from Allah Azza wa Jal. It's certain people are given that. They're wired by Allah Azza wa Jal a specific way to achieve specific tasks. The autistic mind can do things that nobody else can do. And I've come to realize this because all the brothers that I know who are on the autistic, and I've been doing a lot of research, and again, this is another area of research that I'm focusing on, which is the autistic mind is able to notice certain things that most people just don't notice. You look at, and the thing is, the autistic mind, the person with this type of mind, they'll look at people and they'll think, well, how do you not notice this? But the thing is, most people don't notice it. And so people who are on this end, by the way, so everyone listening, anyone who's on this end, or anybody actually, on any part of the spectrum, when you see people and you say, how can you not notice this? Are you dumb? Why? You have to understand that Allah Azza wa Jalla will often give some of us the ability to see certain things or detect certain things. Like in social and navigation, a lot of times an autistic person will be there and they just won't notice how awkward they're being. And a person who's on the bipolar end, who's very, very adept socially and very very strong emotionally, and they're very aware emotionally and very aware of other people's emotions, that person will look at an autistic person on the autistic and say, what's wrong with you? How do you not see people, like, for example, you sat for you were sitting in the gathering for way too long. People wanted, they wanted to go to sleep or something, or you explained yourself for like an hour and a half and everyone was getting bored and you didn't notice everyone getting bored. And so these sorts of things, they have to, the each person has skills and abilities to offer the other and teach the other. That's a general gist of these things. I'm going to just go through two more things quickly, and I'll be done. So we're going to go for a total of an hour, so it's about 15 minutes now. Two more things quickly. So the first thing I want to do is I want to explain a little bit about myself, about some of the things that I've done with my own condition when I was younger and how things have changed over time. And the second thing that I want to talk about is the role of parents with your children and the role of people who believe that they're on the autistic end of the spectrum. So with regards to myself, I'll just keep it brief. Essentially what happened was when I was a teenager, and even my early preteens, but right up to my teenage years and so on, I looking back, I realized that my muscles used to freeze. I used to lock up. My muscles I used to become unable to walk if I felt that people were looking at me. So if I was walking in the mall or walking down the street, I remember specifically walking back from school, there was a stretch of road right before the park, right before then I'd go around and to the house. So as I would approach the park, I remember this happened a lot right on this road. As I'm walking down this road, I'd see children or somebody would be walking by. And if I noticed from the side of that the person's looking at me, right away I would feel my muscles tense up and my eyes swell up and my throat swell up and my whole body would lock up and freeze. So I'd just stop. And I would have to pretend, like open up my bag or look for my pockets, pretending that I'm trying to find something or I forgot something because I'm waiting for my muscles to come back. Socializing was another problem. So I'm from an Iraqi family. Arabs, they love their gatherings, and everyone would come, and I couldn't stand it. I couldn't bear it because sitting around those people was something that I just couldn't control. I couldn't handle. My family used to always get very upset with me because they would say, you know, why don't you be more social? Why don't you, you know, why are you so weird around people? And so I wasn't able to navigate all these types of situations. So it was very, very difficult for me back in those days. And so I never understood it, of course, up until my 30s when I began to, actually until my early 20s when Islam came. So next talk, I'm going to talk about the role of Islam with this and how Islam takes the mess when the autistic mind is a mess and it's disorganized, Islam organizes it. So what happened was that after I came to Islam when I was 20 years old, what Islam did, it took all the abstract things. So the autistic mind can't handle abstract things. Socializing is abstract. People's perception of you is abstract. You can't control these things. You can't make it into a black and white. So the mind short circuits basically when you get into these types of situations. What Islam does is it allows you to make everything objective, and it gives you objectives for everything. And so what I noticed was over the years, not only did I start making every action with an objective, I started looking at people's behavior and I started categorizing people's facial expressions and body movements and their seating position and the way that their tone of voice and the words that they use. And it's primarily because of the da'wah. So it's not because really of anything else other than Allah Azza wa Jal, but it's because of the da'wah. Because I discuss with so many people, I began noticing patterns. Certain people, when I say something, this person react this way, this person react that way. So these groups of people would react this way, and these groups of people would react that way. Suddenly my mind started categorizing all these different types of people and how they would behave towards different responses that I have. The only reason why I know this, by the way, this was happening involuntarily. The only reason why I started noticing this was because after I started studying autism, I went to Jordan, and I went to gatherings of these older brothers and these some just old men, basically 70, 80, 90 years old, and lots of gatherings. This one brother, Miller, reward him. He took me from different families, and he just took me all over the place, and I really enjoyed it. And what I noticed was that when I was in certain gatherings, there was any rational or shari or whatever discussion I could handle. I was just fine because I speak Arabic, alhamdulillah, and everything was just fine. But when there were things like mujamilat, with things like kind of niceties and say, you know, things that you say like يعطيك العافية, or because my brain didn't have a pre-prepared response. So I realized for the first time that when I'm in social gatherings, every time something happens, my brain is saying, this person said this, and these are the possible responses, and this is the response I'm going to use. I know it sounds really weird, but that's actually what my brain does. And so what happened was is that I was sitting with these brothers, and I they were saying things, and I know that it was a nicety. He said, oh, yeah, it's like an afi, and I would say, well, you know, barakallahu fik, or yeah, it's like an afi. I didn't know how to respond, so I would just kind of like freeze. And I saw that awkwardness come back, and I realized, subhanAllah, that's essentially what's happened over these years is I've kind of prepared all these different responses for social interactions. And a lot of people do this. So that's why a lot of people from their younger years, they were socially awkward, but they got better at it as they grew. But the more aware you are of the way that your brain works, the more you're able to take these things and mitigate them. And that's why it's so important for parents now, going to the point of parents, is to understand the nature of your child. Now, maybe you need help, so you can contact me, message me, and I'll help. I'm like, as I said, with this foundation, I want to focus not on essentially babysitting autistic children or going there and doing therapy. What I want to do is to help parents understand who their child is. It's the role of the parent to look at their child to understand what did Allah Azza wa Jal design this child to do, and then give that child everything. So with Muhammad, Muhammad was at about 1 year old. He was non-communicative. He wouldn't look at us. When you'd kind of hug him, he'd push you away. All the typical things. And so we used to just put him in his bouncer and put him near the window so the sun's on him and he's enjoying himself. He's just bouncing around. And so we couldn't find a way to get him to respond to anything. Nothing interested him. He didn't like playing with anything. Everything was out. So one day we put a poster in front of him with letters on it, and he just, there's nothing in this world that's so amazing to him. He was just laughing and so excited, and hours upon hours of just staring at these posters with letters on them. We put numbers in front of him. He was excited for a little while, but then he became a little disinterested. So we realized he could tell the difference between numbers and letters. He wanted letters. So we bring Arabic and we bring Spanish and we bring different posters with different letters. And he just had the most incredible time of his life staring at these posters. So as he got older, when we got him his iPad, we just allowed him to download any program that he wanted. And because we surrounded him with the things that he loved, he was always happy. He almost never had any meltdowns. So I find that in the vast majority of cases, now meltdowns are going to happen with some people, of course, inevitably, because the hearing is too high, or like they're too accustomed to things being quiet and things become loud, or they want to be around other people and they're not. There's lots of possibilities of what could be causing the meltdown. But generally speaking, I believe that most meltdowns are caused by the child being not given what they desperately want to do. So with Muhammad, again, like I said, is that, and that's why I believe, like, you know, things like iPad and whatever, and Muhammad would have small meltdowns if we didn't download the program that he wanted. So, but his programs were not games. He was always downloading language programs and human behavior programs and these sorts of things. At one point he would start studying human behavior. So he would look happy and then he'd look in the mirror and make a happy face. And he'd say, see a picture of sad, and he'd go look in the mirror and he'd make a little sad face. And he started training himself to try to show human expressions, because he realized that, because even we'd be talking about this in the house, he realized that he didn't know how to show express emotions. He was just, you know, he was trying to learn how to communicate, and he's still trying. Then he got into astronomy, so we gave him astronomy books and astronomy apps and astronomy videos, and went out and showed the stars and all this sort of stuff. And then he got into human anatomy, and there's a video I'm going to post, which is just unbelievable. He knows terminology from the human body that essentially only doctors know. There's these apps that he goes through, and they're like, you know, 10 letter words of, I don't even know what the body part is, and I don't even know how to spell it if you get stuck. And he sits there and he looks up and he thinks whatever, and he types in the rest of the word. So that's the thing, is that you need to find what your child's interested in, whatever it is, and just let him do it, even if it's the same thing repetitive for hours on end. And that's why, like, you know, you have, like, there's a book, if anybody wants the foundation, kind of, to give you a really good understanding of the nature of talent within autism, there's a book by a lady named, the boy's name is Jacob Barnett. So the autistic child, he's one of the greatest geniuses in the world currently. His name is Jacob Barnett. The book is called The Spark. So I recommend everybody to go and read this if you want to understand this better. It's a fantastic book. It talks about just his life. It's just a story of his life. And the lady ended up having a daycare for autistic children. And in that, she was nurturing the autistic talents. And so you'll find, you know, children who want to just spin a lid for hours and hours and hours. The thing is, Jacob Barnett, as a child, all he used to do was stare at shadows. So everyone's saying, oh, he's a vegetable, forget about him ever learning anything. And for her, that she kept on insisting on taking him out and teaching him. And now he's one of the greatest geniuses in the world. When he was staring at these shadows, he was studying how the light was moving. He was studying how the shadows functioned, and so on. And when he got older, he explained these things. So that's why when I took Muhammad in for therapy, I told him, look, Muhammad's in a very good place at home. The way that we're raising him and the way that we're nurturing his genius, we want to make sure that it's protected. So I started asking the therapist, you know, what she said, well, we're just trying to mitigate negative behaviors or bad behaviors and promote the good ones. So I said, can you give me an example of a bad behavior? She said, for example, repetitive tasks like spinning things or spinning lids. And I got right away worried. I said, look, that's not a bad behavior. The autistic mind, especially as a child, will do certain things repetitively because they're really focusing in on what their mind wants to understand. And that's why sometimes a child wants to do something that looks a little mundane or a little boring or a little meaningless, but if you allow the child to focus in on this, they become experts at whatever it is that they're seeing. So it's very important that don't look at repetitive tasks as a bad thing. Let them do those repetitive tasks over and over, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of times. And then when they're ready to move on to something else, find out what that is and give that to them. So there's as I said, the head of the autism research department locally here in at the university here. I'm talking to him and so on. And his daughter, so I was having a talk with him, and he's an atheist. So he was saying that essentially autism is he looks at more in terms of from evolution and so on. And so he's very distraught, of course, about his daughter because she has very severe autism and she has a lot of really bad physical ailments. Again, may Allah give her healing and she fought very quickly. And so I was asking him about, you know, because I was telling him, look, there must be something that she's really, really good at. And he says, nope, it's very severe and I've basically mostly lost, not really lost hope, but I've lost hope of her becoming normal or anything like this. So I'm just content with the way that she is and we're just, you know, trying to make sure that she's happy. And I kept on pushing. I said, look, there must be something that she's interested in. Something a little weird, but she's something that really draws her in. What is it? And so I said, you know, maybe it's her loving swinging, but all autistic children love swinging. And so what was it? And then he says, you know, it's barcodes. So I said, what do you mean barcodes? He said, she loves barcodes. There's just something. She goes crazy about barcodes. And so I told him, that's it. You just need to surround her with barcodes. Maybe she's seeing something. And so I told him this, and this is essentially the gist of the point, if you were to boil it down to one simple thing. If you had a person who grew up and they were totally inept socially, and they couldn't drive a car, they could barely even feed themselves, but they were one of the world's greatest encryptionists, or one of the world's greatest decryptionists, or whatever, let's just say encryption. A person is able to detect counterfeit money just the moment that they look at it, because they can see things that no one else can detect or notice with their eyes. The thing is that this person would be so absolutely invaluable in the department of encryption or counterfeit detection and so on. So a lot of times we tend to look at, oh, well, the child has to have some sort of like normal social life. And the answer is no. We just have to find what is a child supposed to do. Just because a human being has talent doesn't mean that it's ever going to be realized. It can be wasted, and that's it. It's gone. And that's why it's our responsibility as people to find the talent of the child, of the autistic person in our life, or anyone who we can influence, and then surround them with it. Even though we think, I don't see where this is going, it doesn't matter what you think. Just surround them with the things that they want to do. You'll find they'll have less meltdowns. You'll find that they're much happier. Let them enjoy and do the things that they are obsessed with doing. And just wait to see what comes of it. There's a hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He says, "Kullu muyassarun lima khuliqa lah." This is one of the hadith that is, in my opinion, the foundation of even this research, which is everybody, whatever Allah has created you to do, Allah will make it easy for you to do. And that's why what you do is when you look at your child, you try to find where is that avenue. What does Allah push them towards? What do they love doing? What do they find passionate? If it has to do with staring at barcodes, let them stare at barcodes. If it has to do with fiddling with something for hours and hours, let them fiddle. Maybe they're hearing something. Maybe they're seeing something. And then in time, this becomes their expertise. So I'm going to quickly skim through some of the questions. If anybody has any questions, you can go ahead and ask. Sister Shabana asks, should all schools test kids to help them get the best out of their abilities rather than have one size fits all education system? Realistically, it's just not going to happen. You can't really have an education system that's so variable depending on the person. While the current education system is not very good, because the Islamic model is much, much better, which has to do with much more one-on-one, where an idea is explained and then everyone participates in explaining or asking questions and it goes back and forth. But regardless of that model, the biggest problem that I find is that to find talent, you need people who are good at finding talent. Now, all parents can get a general idea. Just look what the child loves to do and just give it to them. But sometimes you need help. So you need people who are very good at detecting talent. And that's why, I'm hoping that this foundation, I haven't yet decided on a name. So if anybody wants to send me ideas, I'm open to ideas of what to call the organization. But I think I'm going to call it something like Finding Talent or something related to talent, because that's really what it comes down to. That's really the most important part of it. It's the practical aspect. It's not just about coming all these theories and so on. It's about practically understanding, well, what can we do with this? What is the role? What is the purpose of this mind type in this world? So once we understand the role, then we can understand, okay, how do we best work with it in order to maximize its potential and maximize the potential of the autistic people that are around us. And that's why it's important. So that's why this. Hopefully people can come to this foundation and say, look, this is my autistic child. Can you please work with the child and try to figure out what the child is good at? And to be honest, in many cases, it's going to be a short conversation. So it's a matter of just asking some things, and they're going to say, well, he loves to turn lights on and off. Or hear clicking noise. So it might be the light that he likes to turn on and off, and it might be the clicking noises. And so first you want to factor everything out. So you want to have a light that doesn't have batteries and you allow him to click it. If he gets upset and he wants the light, you turn the light on, you get a light that doesn't have a clicking noise. And if he still turns on and off, then that means it's the light that he wants, not the clicking noise. And so on. So once you figure out what specifically it is that the child is interested in, and suddenly, again, if you have a child who loves lights, turn them on and off, bring him 100 flashlights with different colors and strobes and everything you can possibly bring, and let him play with this and let him go crazy until he gets bored. And then he's going to start getting interested in something else, like Muhammad went towards astronomy. It's just that the mind is growing, and sometimes certain things that are interlinked in terms of space and in terms of what's going on the earth, and so you never know how things interlink. And in the end, when they get older, how all these details come together to make him into the person that he's going to be. So don't start making assumptions. Don't think that you know best for them. Just let them guide you. Let them lead you to the direction that they want to go, because they're seeing things that you're not detecting. What if they can hear a sound that you can't hear? Like for me, for example, hearing the capacitors in printers or hearing the capacitors in certain electronics. So the person's going to say, well, what are you getting upset about? Like, let's say if I was a small child and I was screaming and shouting and I was banging, I don't know where the sound is coming from, but it's driving me completely crazy. Even right now, if I'm sitting at the computer and I have to unplug the printer, I have to. So if it's plugged in, I would be, and I remember actually one time I came home and I was working on a document. I worked for about an hour and I know that the sound was on, but it didn't click. I was so distracted. And suddenly I realized, like, why am I getting so irritated? What's bothering me so much? So I unplugged the printer and I felt this calmness come over me. And I realized that it was the printer that was driving me crazy. So a lot of times you have to look at what the child's trying to tell you, or your teenage son or daughter or whatever it might be, what they're trying to lead you towards. So don't always think that you're able to sense everything, or you figured it all out. So that's why, yes, it would be good if schools had this, and maybe hopefully in time, as this project grows and more research is made and more documentation is written and people understand more, then people can be trained to work with this and detect this. And generally all humans, really, society should revolve around detecting people's abilities. So instead of having lots of average doctors, people running towards status and money, instead of being an average doctor, maybe you're an incredible educator. Maybe so why waste your time on something when, you have status and money, but again, we're living in a capitalist world where people, you might not make enough money, minimum wage or whatever, as a teacher. But the point is that society should revolve around that. And again, that's when we talk about Islam as a solution, we realize that that's the solution in time. But in the meantime, we have to understand that you need to look at what your strengths are, and you need to nurture them. And you can live your whole life not nurturing them. I know people who are absolute geniuses when it comes to certain things, like a certain brother knows he's a genius when it comes to political analysis and international relations. He's just incredible, but he wants to be an electrical engineer, and he's average. I've told him, if you work the hardest you could ever, put in maximum effort, you put in all of your time, how good of an engineer? He said, well, maybe just a little above average. I said, if you become a political analyst or a journalist or something like this, and put in little to no effort. He said, I'm probably better than anyone else that I know. And it's true. I know he's actually exceptionally talented at this area. And he's wasting his talents. But because what's he going to make money from? How's he going to, what's he going to be? Like, he could be a journalist. He doesn't know where to go. What is he going to become, a professor in university in political science? So the problem is there's certain people who are exceptionally good at something, but there's just not enough money in it, or there's not enough career avenues. And so the talent gets wasted. So that's the thing, is that's why, even I think it was Einstein who said that I can't remember who it is, but somebody said that if a fish were to be judged on how it can climb a tree, the fish would feel awfully stupid, something like that. So you can't, different people are good at different things. So social navigation, certain people are genius at it. They're amazing at networking. I can't even begin to understand it. Other people are incredible at detecting human behavior, reading body language. So that's, alhamdulillah, shukr, that's what Allah has given me as one of my strengths, is I can read people's body language to the point where it's really interesting what I can see in people. And then other people, they're extremely good at science. Certain people like Muhammad are good at language. Certain people are good at physical sports and things like this. And sometimes it's a mix. So certain people are good at a few things, very good at a few things, but they're not the peak, like not super geniuses, and usually geniuses are only really good at a few things, and they're really not good at a bunch of other things. So it's important to get a person to understand this too, to understand that, look, you're great at these things. You don't have to be great at everything else, but you're extremely good at this one thing. So become the best at it, to the best of your ability. Will you let Muhammad go to a normal school? Yes. So Muhammad right now, he's just been transitioned into a normal high school. Now, normally I'm very uncomfortable with my children going to a public school because of the profanities and all the talk about sexual education and the really bad behavior by children, and really the fact that so many kids come out drugs and all the things that Islam forbids, obviously male-female relations and girls getting pregnant at the age of 14, 15, and all this garbage that takes place in these societies, and also the bullying and the emotional trauma and the anxiety and the free mixing and all the problems that exist in these schools because there's no guidance. The children are not given guidance on how they're feeling, and just very little. It's just math and science, and then, the kids are just kind of left to their devices in terms of their morality. And so, but with Muhammad, because he goes in with a therapist, and also he's not really affected too much by the social environment, he's been transitioned into a public school, and he's doing great. Now, what's great in terms of, he's obviously not participating like other kids are in the same way, but he's able to sit down, he's still able to pay attention, and I'm noticing dramatic changes in him. He's a lot more disciplined, he listens to instructions much, much better now, so he's really growing. So that's why it's really, really important to, like, I really do believe in IBI and ABA therapy, but you have to find people who are, you have to make sure that you're, wherever you're getting it done, you're a city that they're really professional, that they're good at what they're doing. And it really brings the autistic child out of their isolation. You have to always keep them with other kids. You always have to force them. So therapy is very, very good. And Temple Grandin also very strongly advises it. She said it's what got her out of her non-communicative isolation. And so you can't let your autistic children sit and just play video games all day, because that isolation is so comfortable. It's so easy. And that's why you find a lot of these amazing kids who are amazing at video games. And they're just living in this world, and because it's so easy, you don't have to socially interact with anybody directly. You can just talk to a screen, you can just talk to a microphone, and you can just play your video games, and you're very good at the video games, and it gives you a sense of achievement. And that's the problem, is that you can't let them do that. You have to force them to be directly in front of other kids and constantly, because it's uncomfortable, because you want the brain to rewire itself so that the person trains himself or herself on how to deal and how to navigate social circumstances. So Muhammad is now in public school, and he's doing really, really well because of this. So I really believe in this, but you have to be careful. You always have to be watching, even if you put your own kids, and even in Islamic school, you always have to be watching what they're going through and being involved with them at home, and always, you have to be involved as a parent. You can't just pass them on and be like, he's going to be great. No, it's everything starts from the home, whether your kids are in the middle of the spectrum or on the autistic or on the bipolar end. It doesn't matter. You have to be very heavily involved with your children, and you have to be watching them, and because it's you. They're your children, they're your blood, you will understand them the best. You'll see them their behavior at home. And you also have to be listening to what's happening at school and what they're being taught, and then trying to build on that. With, again, what happened with Muhammad's autism, with Muhammad's therapy, and also right now with his schooling, I contacted the school and I realized there's a lot of things they didn't even understand. Even though they have the therapist there, I had to tell them, no, you have to do these things. So for example, they didn't know that Muhammad, they didn't know that one of the things that they could do with Muhammad is open up a Google Translate program and then type in a word, and then whatever a word like Arabic or Spanish or French will pop up. He'll just say that word. He'll know it even before it pops up. They were blown away. Actually, Muhammad, the first sentence Muhammad learned was, all truths are easy to understand once they are discovered. The key is to discover them, or something is to discover them, which is a quote from Galileo. And so he was at school and he typed it out. And so they didn't realize a lot of these things. So I had to go there and I had to talk to them and explain to them why he's, you know, where he is. And for me, of course, we're used to it, but they were just like, so, you know, excited about it. And so that's the thing, is you have to be involved. You have to give the teachers guidance and clarity, and the therapists themselves, you have to give them some instruction of what his talents are, because they're not there to find his talent. Most therapists are, you know, in their 20s and their early 30s. They're not going to have this great depth. Most therapists, actually, I'll say all therapists that I've come across so far, they have done almost no research on autism. They've never read Temple Grandin's books. They've never read the book Neurotribes. They've never read The Spark. They've never read The Reason Why I Jump. They've never read, they haven't watched videos or any, they've done almost no research. They went and took a certificate. They understand the behavioral therapy part, which is how to get them to practice and so on, to communicate, but they don't actually understand autism itself. So I found that kind of baffling, and I found it very disappointing. But you just have to understand, okay, fine, this is the reality of it. This is how they are. So you had to be more involved with them and give them direction. So I told them, look, these are the things that I want Muhammad to focus on. And they said, okay, we'll make sure that we integrate these things into his therapy. So you have to make sure that you're very, very involved on all levels with your child. Yeah, actually, Jazakallah Khair, Haq Abdul, he said Gifted Minds Foundation. I kind of like that name, Gifted Minds Foundation. That could work. But then again, the problem is that it's only assuming that, okay, that means it's almost as if it's a talent, like a talented child foundation, rather than, because it's not, you don't have to be gifted, like you don't have to be known to be gifted to be working. I don't know, well, anyways, we'll see. So Amina says, I think, or Amina says, I think autistic parents have the upper hand in picking out what their child talents are. And that's very true. The earlier you start working on your child, the faster you will understand, the easier it will be to understand. I have lots of people come to me and their child is a teenager. At teenage years, it's so much harder because they've already worked through a lot of things and they've gotten pretty good at a lot of things. But as a child, 2, 3, 4 years old, they're not going to be good at almost anything. If they're suddenly really good at one thing, you know, okay, this is what they're good at. But in the teenagers, they're going to have lots of interests. So it's going to be much, much harder to navigate through and sift through to kind of figure out, well, what is it that they're good at? But at the age of 2 or 3 or 4, especially at the age of 1, it's suddenly, like Muhammad spelled the word elephant, with foam letters, okay, well, we realize, well, that's not normal. So, okay, so he's good. He's okay. We can get an idea of what he's kind of good at. If a child can memorize an entire page of something or draw a whole thing, you know, just from a single memory, okay, you know what they're good at. But again, as you get older, you get better at drawing, you get better. So it's harder to kind of tell where their talents lie. So the sooner you start, the easier it is to figure out where their talents are. And then, of course, with regards to the autism research that exists, there's a lot going on. But the real problem is that everyone who's involved with the realm of autism research and therapy and so on, everyone's flooded and everyone is just overwhelmed with the amount of interest and the amount of work that there is to do. So I contacted Jacob Barnett's mother, and she said that she just doesn't have any time to do anything else. There's so many different people. Like, again, lots and lots of Google staff members, the ones who have, you know, real talent, most of them, if not potentially even all of them, are on the autistic end of the spectrum. They're very black and white. Like, there's that one guy, I forget his name, he wrote that memo about women, their gender roles and so on. And he got fired because of it, which he really shouldn't have. I think the vast majority of what he said was absolutely correct. But the thing is, that's the point, is that, again, people who are on the autistic end will just say things as they are. This is how they are, black and white. Why would you disagree? It's so obvious. But again, people on the bipolar end, all these, you know, really emotional people, and they get really upset and they all panic and freak out because they're judging things emotionally. How do I feel about what he's saying? Instead of, what is he saying? How do I feel? This upsets me. This offends me. And so therefore it's wrong. So then they get really upset and they march out and they make a big fuss. The thing is, the autistic end is like, well, men are physically different than women. Men are physically, on average, stronger than women, et cetera, et cetera. So men are different than women. Okay, you're fired for saying this because that's insensitive. What do you mean it's insensitive? Are you crazy? It's black and white. But the bipolar end, the more emotional judgment, how do I feel? How are people going to feel? The implications. What if you do this? Oh, look what people are going to do. People are going to react this way. So they look at the implications. They look at the possibilities. And they look at, whereas this is just facts and figures. Autistic is just black and white. This is what it is. Why would you disagree? I don't really care what's going to happen. All I care about is the facts. Whereas the bipolar is more about what's going to happen and the implications and so on and so forth. So that's the gist. There's so much more to go through. But that's all I really am going to go through today. And I'm going to have more. So I just wanted to give an overview. This is just an overview. In further videos, I'm going to go in much more detail on different aspects. I'm just going to pick one aspect and go into much, much more detail on it. One thing I do want to give is some suggestions on reading. So number one is the book called The Spark. This is my number one suggestion. This is the starting point that I really think everyone should go to. The Spark. It's written by, I think it's Catherine Barnett, or it's, again, hold on, let me just quickly search this. Christine. So Christine Barnett, it's written by Christine Barnett about her son, Jacob Barnett, who's now, again, so just read the book. You'll see, you'll understand who Jacob is. He now lives in Canada. He actually lives near me in Waterloo. I've been trying to set up a meeting to go meet with him and discuss them and discuss with the mother. But again, they're just really busy people, which is understandable. So The Spark is a very good starting point. Another really important starting point is Temple Grandin. She is the most famous autistic person in the world. She's the first very highly communicative, severely autistic person. So she really began explaining herself in great detail and created a huge new kind of breakthrough in terms of understanding autism. So there's a movie called Temple Grandin. So T-E-M-P-L-E, Temple. And her last name is Grandin, G-R-A-N-D-I-N, Temple Grandin. So watch that movie because you'll get an understanding of her life and what she did and how she thinks and so on and how the autistic mind works. There's a video you can search on Google, which is on YouTube. It's called, just search Temple Grandin Google, or Temple Grandin Talk Google. And she gave a talk to Google, which is a very important talk. She talked about how the neural pathways work and so on. And she has a number of books, so just basically pick any of her books on autism and read it. She's got just a huge amount of insight, really incredible insight into the nature of autism. There's a book called Neurotribes. I haven't finished it, so I can't really comment on the book overall, but it's got a lot of excellent facts in it. And there's a book called The Reason Why I Jump. Those are the main ones that I recommend that everybody reads, and to give you a good understanding of the nature of autism. So, so if anyone else has any more questions, please feel free to ask. And if not, then we'll end. We'll end here. I'll give it another couple minutes. I'll see if. Oh, right. There's one more thing that I wanted to mention. last thing I wanted to mention is the fact that a lot of times a lot of parents, they see the physical ailments of their autistic child, and they think that because the physical ailments are so severe, there's not much we can do. Again, the head of the department that I speak to, his daughter has some really, she just came out of intensive care. So because of this, one would feel like, oh, there's, you know, that's it. She's ruined for life. But if you look at Stephen Hawking, for example, regardless of whether or not he's on the spectrum, it's difficult to tell, obviously, because of his communication problems, because of the actual inability to talk due to a physical, like, you know, he's got really severe muscle issues. But look at how severe his physical disability is, and look at how highly revered he is. Just because a person has physical ailments doesn't mean that that's going to affect their mind's ability to participate in this world. So don't look at your child's physical ailments if they have muscle tissue damage, or if they have their whole body's, you know, locked up, or if they're just, you know, just simply not moving. Because if you read the book, The Reason Why I Jump, he talks about him being totally non-communicative and almost non-functioning physically, and he still discusses and explains why, or he's still very articulate. And so there's lots and lots of people who have that really serious physical problems, but their mind is working not only perfectly, but it's at a very, very high level of thinking, and it's a genius mind. So don't discount your child due to their physical illness. They might have lots and lots of major physical problems, but they might still become extremely valuable in a particular field in this world, whether it's in Islamic sciences or in biology and chemistry and so on, mathematics, or whatever else in this world that particular mind is dedicated by Allah Azza wa Jal to work on and to help with. So that's a really important aspect, is not to become confused by the physical ailments and judge the mental state because of this. All right, so if there are no more questions, then I'll end here. It's been an hour and a half, so I think that's plenty. Jazakumullah khair, everyone, for staying. Most people stayed, which is really good. Barakallahu bikum, and inshallah, we'll continue this discussion. If anybody has any questions, if you want me to be involved with your family, like with your children, I'm happy to meet the children. I'm happy to discuss and try to find where the child's talent is, whether it's here locally in my city, or whether it's anywhere in Canada where I can access, or any online discussions. Now, if it comes to meeting the child, obviously it's best if I sit with the child and I talk to them and I figure things out. In most cases, I only have to talk to the parent and just meet the child. But sometimes I have to sit there and work with the child a little bit in order to be able to figure out where they are. But that's the thing, is I'm now going to dedicate some of my time to focusing on this aspect, which is helping families figure out the mental capabilities of their child and how to best work with this in the most positive way to produce the most to bring out the potential of their child as much as possible and raise a child that'll be happy. That's the most important thing, obviously, for the child to be happy and to feel that they're contributing positively towards society and not treated like just some handicapped kids who can't do anything and we'll just give them some toys to play with or something like that. No, these minds are a gold mine. These minds are so vitally important to the progress and technology of mankind, and we have to essentially dedicate our time to bringing out all this talent and so on. Jazakumullah khair. Subhanakallah bihamdik. Nashhadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.